dressing up for the carnival. A portrait of Carol Shields. BBC. Author Carol Shields, a white woman in her mid-60s, hugs a man at a high-class event.
I'm not interested, the way some people are, in being sad. I've had a look, and there's nothing down that road. No, Ms. Winters of Orangetown much prefers the more calculated protocols of dodging sadness with her deliberate maneuvers. She has an instinct for missing the call of grief.
You're looking fantastic.
Today, she collected the Pulitzer Prize for her work, The Stone Diaries. Welcome.
This is Canada's most prestigious literary award. And this year, it celebrates the elegant clarity of Carol Shields' novel, The Stone Diaries.
Her characters are ordinary, but Carol Shields is no ordinary writer.
Stone Diaries is her sixth novel, and the bookies make it 9-4 favorite.
And writer Carol Shields, having won a Governor General's Literary Award, today she became an officer of the order.
So it should be really good fun. Right?
Sometimes I still don't think of myself as a writer. It's a curious thing. Nothing in my life prepared me to be able to say that I am a writer.
Isn't a safe man in Cyprus.
I always feel, and I kind of shuffle my feet when I say it, that, well, you know, I sort of write a little, and, you know, I sort of work away at fiction. And to come out and say it is almost to invite the gods to come and take it away from you. I wanted to write about the lives of women, the kind of women that I knew, women whose lives were rather like mine, women who were middle class, I suppose, women who were struggling to raise children, to have some kind of a life of the mind, because I wasn't seeing those books, I wasn't seeing them published in the early 70s, because I was in that little place between generations where I wasn't quite an old style woman like my mother, who had no great expectations in her life, and I wasn't quite a new born feminist who felt that I could just take the world in my hands. I was in between, and I didn't quite know what I was, and I suppose I wanted to give some kind of voice to that.
It's 8 o'clock. News and information that hits home.
Hello. How are you?
Faye thinks how fortunate she is to live in a place where the air is relatively pure and where she can almost always, even during rush hour, get a seat on the bus. She finds herself inspecting the other passengers intently and notes with surprise. Why should she be surprised? That those who ride the early morning buses are mainly women, a separate caste, who seem to carry with them a suggestion of their flushed domestic chaos, the imprint of families hurriedly fed and admonished, cupboard doors left ajar, and greasy cups and plates stacked in the sink until evening.
Critic Mark Lawson.
At that stage, particularly in the 1970s, there was a feeling that the domestic was trivial and irrelevant, and particularly the female domestic. I mean, there was a strong feeling of that. And so they were seen as really books about nothing and very slight books.
It was the days of, if we can now call it that, high feminism. So her characters were, on the whole, either happily married or, you know, not going out to kind of kill all the dragons in sight. And therefore, I think she got somewhat overlooked at that time. As the 80s came in, that effect faded, and also she was writing bigger and more accomplished books.
Carol's typing on her computer at home.
With Stone Diaries, I had a structure. I had a couple of structures, and I tried to put them together. First of all, I just wanted to move a woman's life through the years of the 20th century, more or less. And I wanted to cut into it about every 10 years, not exactly every 10 years. I wanted to vary that a little bit so I wouldn't look too systematic somehow, schematic.
I started out with an interest in limestone because of the way it's made. You know, it's a it's inorganic material, but it's made from organic material. It's made from all these little sea creatures that have been crushed and pressed together over millions of years. So there's something about that metaphorical exchange that appeals to me. And I was also interested, I was going to call this book Flower in Stone at one time, because I liked the idea of something huge and powerful and indestructible as stone, and something as fragile and miraculous and delicate as a flower. Those two textures, those two essences, really.
A red lorry carries giant grey blocks of limestone across a quarry.
The stone itself, a dolomitic limestone, is more beautiful and easier to handle than that which my father knew growing up in Stonewall, Manitoba. Natural chemical alterations give it its unique, lacy look. It comes in two colors, a light buff mixed with brown, and my favorite, a pale gray with darker gray mottles.
A reading from the Stone Diaries.
All she's trying to do is keep things straight in her head, to keep the weight of her memories evenly distributed, to hold the chapters of her life in order.
The breakthrough novel, of course, was The Stone Diaries, because that was shortlisted for the Booker and won the Pulitzer and the American Book Critics Circle Award and the Canadian Governor General's Award, and was published all over the world. And it was one of those books that Entertainment Weekly was touting it as great summer reading. You could find it in bookstores in Australia, and it was the top seller in the New York Times. So it was just, that was the one that made her into an international success.
In The Stone Diaries, there was everything that had been there before, which was the wry and ironic treatment of a woman's life, but there was also a quite clear literary infrastructure to do with the way in which fiction works, the way in which biography works, the differences between autobiography and biography. And I think for that reason, it was a breakthrough book.
Carol carries a plant into her dining room.
I don't think I sat down and said to myself, I am going to write in this particular way. I'm going to provide for the reader a layer of tiny details, domestic details, that I hope will unlock what lies beneath it. I don't think I said that to myself. It felt like the most natural thing in the world to talk about. Well, here's an example. Almost everyone I know loves to set a table. And I might be wrong about this, and there might be people, but I have never read in a novel about anyone setting a table and about the particular pleasure of doing that. And that's a domestic detail, but it also is, it's more than that. It's a kind of offering, isn't it, that you might be able to give. And I guess I felt those ceremonies and meant something more than the simple acts that they appeared to describe.
A series of black and white photographs of Carol as a child, from performing a headstand in the front garden, to playing with a doll, to standing with her sister and brother in front of her father. Now, a photograph of Carol as a smiling teenager, kneeling on the grass in a park and holding an open book.
I grew up in Oak Park, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. I have one brother and one sister. I was the bookish one in the family, the youngest child. My mother was a teacher. My father was a businessman. There were books in the house, not a lot of books. We used the public library. That was very much a family weekly outing was to go to the public library. And then eventually I got so that I could go by myself, so that in the summer I would go every second day to trade in my books for a new set. I loved school. I was a goody-goody girl and always did my homework and worked hard and just loved school, except for mathematics, which I wasn't good at.
More photographs of Carol throughout the years, from going in for the kiss with her husband on their wedding day to posing with all of her five children as they grow from infants to toddlers. A colour photo of Carol's one son and four daughters smiling in an alleyway.
For middle-class girls, American girls, which I was, our future was quite predictable. We were going to get married and have children, and I think we never thought beyond that moment what else we might do. I met Don in 1955 when I was a student in England, and he was there as well as a graduate student from Canada. I was at Exeter University and I'd come into London to spend the weekend with Don. Not spend the weekend. I mean, we didn't do that in those days, but...
We were always looking for places to neck him on riverbanks and things. So I proposed we come here one day. So we came on our little motorcycle, parked out front of the gates. There were not as many rules and regulations then. Yeah. And we were in here so long, like most of the day, that when we came out, we had a parking ticket.
All right. Don, now we're ready. Do you want to get the girls out, darling? I married at 22. He was 22 as well. We have what they call now a long marriage, 43 years. So I knew right from the beginning that it was going to be very good.
Whoa, stop. That's lots.
I wouldn't eat this stuff myself, of course, for $1 million.
Carol's filling bowls with porridge oats cooked over the hob.
And Doris porridge, yes. It keeps them glued together and happy.
What are you guys doing?
He's picking up and I don't know where. We have a son, the oldest child, and four daughters. So there's 10 years between the youngest and oldest child.
Did you leave your shirt at the coffee shop, Eli?
Oh, brother, probably. As each child gets married, we get a clock and a husband, too. And but then, you know, this is given so gracefully to us, but then the moment we get it, my father runs out and quickly replaces it, you know, with something as close as possible to it.
Being a mother, I have to say, has been the most important experience in my life, and the hardest work I've ever had, and the best work, and the most rewarding work.
You have to listen to the pendulum speed.
I always
it tells you whether or not the clock is set. Do you know what I mean?
Which side is the nail?
Oh, this is the true ceremonial moment.
It's 3:01.
Oh my gosh. There you go.
Now
really
is.
This is a very symbolic moment. Let's have some music, everybody.
Now is the hour. Is this the
when I first started writing, it was in a very small way. And every year, I had a little more time as my children became slightly more independent, went off to school. Actually had lunch at school. That was a big thing, because then I had more of the day to myself. So it was very incremental.
So Evan, can you pass me?
I'm not going to play.
Okay, don't play.
Don't play.
I think when my children were very young, they probably just thought I was a mother who typed more than other mothers. And I didn't write at night because I was usually too tired, and I didn't write on weekends because there were kids all over the house.
Somebody you don't like very well.
No, we'll give them two mics.
I wrote, not in secret exactly, but I wrote in those moments when I was alone.
I suppose every friend's mother had something. You know, one was divorced and one was a horse rider. So my mom typed.
she always seemed to be typing. And sometimes she just seemed to be typing in her head, like that she was thinking. Sometimes she'd be driving and her fingers would be going on the steering wheel.
She had a big old heavy manual typewriter at which she thundered away. But it didn't connect with any end product any more than, you know, she did laundry, the loads went in, and didn't seem to be anything sort of arising out of it. It was just something that she did.
And then I wanted to write a novel, and I think I said, I'm going to see if I can write a novel. I had no sense that I might be able to do it, finish it. It seemed like an enormous project.
She published her first novel when she was 40, I believe, and so poems in her 30s. She had already cranked out 5 kids. So I don't think there's anything late about it. I sort of marvel that she was able to do it that soon.
She was kind of funny because we'd come home from school and, you know, the first thing you say to your mom is, you know, what are we having for dinner? Or can I have all my friends over? And she'd always be writing. She's like, sometimes it was kind of hard for her to stop. And so she'd be madly typing away and answering all of our questions at the same time. But she couldn't quite stop yet. Like she had maybe another page to do or something. And so we'd say, what's for dinner? And she'd say, we're having chicken and rice. And meanwhile, she was still typing madly away. And I was always amazed that she could keep track of 2 conversations at the same time, the one in her head and the one she was having with us kids.
We would stand around her in our nightgowns in the evening if she was typing and rip those pages out of the roll as they came off and squabble over who got to read the next page first. I mean, I don't know how she tolerated us, really. I do think for a large chunk of her writing career, she was typing with one hand and holding us at bay with the other in order to carve out that space to finish the next paragraph.
Yes. Carol's now perusing the shelves inside a bookshop.
I think I was one of those kids who found language endlessly fascinating. In fact, one of the very few spiritual experiences I've ever had was understanding that those symbols on the page could be translated into words. That day when I learned how to read, it was miraculous to me.
Dawn selects a book from one of the packed shelves and looks it over. He now turns around and lets out an incredulous chuckle.
A novel reader? Are you kidding? I have only one novelist that I follow. I read no others anymore. I got through all my Mickey Spillane and Sex and Violence days of reading those novels when I was in university. I have to wait not only until the book is published, but till the first reviews are in, and then I'm given the reviews and the book. So I know what to think and what to say. So, and that's it.
Getting in print certainly was very important to me. And I think this is more important maybe for women than for men, because women always have to give excuses about why they're writing, stealing time from their families, as it were, especially women in a traditional family as ours was. And so that first publication gave me that kind of permission to be a writer.
Carol focuses intently while typing away on her computer. Pylons towering over vast yellow fields.
Canada is a country where nothing ever seems to happen. A country always dressed in its Sunday go-to-meeting clothes. A country you wouldn't ask to dance a second waltz. Clean, Christian, dull, quiescent, but growing. Yes, it must be admitted the Dominion is growing.
A lorry towing a white trailer races down a quiet country road. Carol's now traveling in her car.
Showers or afternoon thunder showers later today with the CJOB guaranteed high of 18. Partly cloudy and 8 tonight. Tuesday, mix of sun and cloud, highs to 19. Winnipeg now, 12. Skies are sunny. Enjoy it while we've got it, I guess.
And the question arises, what is the story of a life? A chronicle of fact? Or a skillfully wrought impression? The bringing together of what she fears? Or the adding up of what has been offhandedly revealed? She needs a quiet place in which to think about this immensity.
Standing out on a balcony, Carol gazes down at a river flowing nearby, the surface of the water sparkling in the radiant sunlight. Sometime later, Carol's inside her home office, working diligently on her computer.
I can never really get what's in my head entirely onto paper. I've never done it yet. But you hope, you know, you hope if you stick at it long enough that you can get to some sort of an approximation. And there are some times when I have actually sat for an hour reworking one sentence.
I love to make sentences. It's the part about writing that I like best. And I love to write long sentences, kind of long, curly-ended sentences, just to see where they can go.
So what she's obviously trying for, and which we all do, is words appropriate to the moment. You're not talking about toothpaste, in which it's the same all the way through. Her characters have high points and low points, and they have moments of crisis, and they have other moments of reflection. So it's not a sort of homogeneous dough that she's working on. She's working on words to make those moments happen.
The style isn't as distinctive as Jane Austen's, but then who would be? I mean, Jane Austen is one of the most distinctive prose styles that there's ever been. But it's very much in that tradition that every line is wry or ironic or twisted in some way.
Incredibly precise and incredibly sort of well observed of human nature, and that's something that I like about Carol as a person too. She has to be the most amazing listener of anyone I've ever met.
Carol opens a drawer, revealing a collection of multicolored files.
I always print out what I've written and work at it by hand. I pick up that pen and I work around it because the computer is really a fairly crude editing machine. It can't do everything you can do with a pen. Like, you can circle things or underline things or write up and down the margin, and it looks a mess, but it's extraordinarily sophisticated in terms of editing. I love doing that. I love revising. But that's where the real pleasure of writing comes for me, bringing it to represent as nearly as you can that golden book in your head.
Reading from Swan.
Hanging in my closet are three dresses, dry clean only, two expensive suits and eight silk blouses, in such colours as hyacinth and brandy. Not a large wardrobe, perhaps, but richly satisfying. I've read my Thoreau. I know real wealth lies in the realm of the spirit. But still, I'm a person who can, in the midst of depression, be roused by the rub of a cashmere scarf in my fingers.
And the publishing side.
Oh, and I can be restless and difficult. Some days, Virginia Woolf is the only person in the universe I want to talk to. But she's dead, of course, and wouldn't like me anyway. Too flip.
Oh, it's Penguin. Oh, it is. Oh, it is. Uh-huh. And in the spirits as well. Oh, wow.
Charleston Festival.
Oh, aren't these beautiful? Look. Oh, isn't this wonderful?
In fact, in one review, which was otherwise a nicely favorable review, I was described as the bard of the banal. I'm still recovering from that.
It was actually a novel called Swan that came to me first. And I fell in love with it on page one, and I can still remember the sentence that I just thought, you know, this novel's got to go terribly wrong if I'm not going to acquire it on the spot.
England got onto her and her virtues almost before any other country. That's my impression.
Carol leaves the stage at the Hay Festival with a single rose.
Hi, Lily. Thank you.
Carol Shields here. This is the Carol Shields. Carol Shields.
I suppose it is the validation of women's experiences. And
them, you know, the humour, the same kind of Jane Austen type asides, the quiet humour, the incisiveness, the perceptiveness.
The clarity of language is very stunning as well, and it's very easy reading as well, although there is depth to her writing as well.
It gives you a chance to find out who reads your books. I never really know who reads my books, but you find out when you go to something like this because people come up and talk to you. But it does wear you out. You really need to go away and suck your thumb.
In a cafe.
No one gets named Larry anymore. It's had it as a name. Think of someone called Larry and you automatically conjure up a guy drinking beer in a 60s rec room. He's wearing polyester pants. He's watching the ball game on TV and belching softly. Next, he's reaching under his T-shirt and scratching his belly hairs and doesn't care who sees him do it.
No.
No.
You know, you folks... I don't know.
When I came to write Larry's Party, it wasn't a political decision. It was simply that I was curious about where men were. I began to see all around me, and of course, because I worked in a university, I could see in our employment process that it was suddenly a handicap to be a male, a white male, if you wanted to be taken in to the university. And I knew that men had, in many other ways, had subtractions, major subtractions made from their lives in terms of their sense of entitlement.
We're going to get five?
We're going to get five.
You want us all?
What a gender distribution, though. Oh. Is there something wrong with this?
It's going to be nice.
Larry's Party answers the question, what was it like to be a man in the second half of the 20th century? You follow an average man, a man who, I think Carol says in the book, you know, gets lost, stumbles, falls, but is willing to try again and get himself found. That's what it's about. And he goes through the things that everybody does, you know, a failed marriage, failed relationships with his children, letting things lapse with his family, wondering why he didn't say more to his parents. Universal concerns.
You got to the middle, did you?
Oh, hello.
I thought of each chapter as a little maze that he got into and out of, and then the whole thing as a sort of larger maze of mazes, so that his getting himself to the middle of the maze is only half your life. You have to then find the rest of the way. So I think I was thinking along those rather corny metaphorical lines.
Is this a dead end?
No.
You come out where we started. Well, that's good. That's where the exit is.
You have to get to the middle place where the trees are. So.
No, but we're not, because I think we made that mistake.
And thousands of people misled by your book, dear.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
Where you go?
Okay, we have to go back.
I'll wait for you here.
Okay.
Without thinking, he had slowed his pace, falling behind the others, willing himself to be lost, to be alone. He wondered exactly how lost a person could get. Lost at sea, lost in the woods,
where is the actual
fatally
place?
Lost.
Is it here?
He had been reflecting about love, about the long, steady way his imperfect parents managed to love each other, and about his own deficient love for Dory, how it came and went, how he kept finding it and losing it again. And now, here in this garden maze, getting lost and then found, seemed the whole point. That, and the moment of willed abandonment, the unexpected rapture of being blindly led.
Carol's looking lost in a hedge maze.
I'm completely lost.
A black and white Polaroid photo of Carol as a baby wearing a large summer hat, then holding a doll as a slightly older child, and doing a headstand in the garden. As a young woman, Carol's kneeling with a book. Then she's in her wedding dress.
Maybe once in every hour, we lose it for 30 seconds. Our whole sense of who we are and the way we fit into the universe. I think people are enormously frail. This last year and a half, I've been... ill, and someone who's been healthy always, and to be struck with a serious illness, of course it changes the way you think of your life. You become aware of, you know, what you call in science, they call it the rogue factor. You know, one of your cells has decided to multiply in a peculiar way, and then that has spread in your body. And it's part of this. I was thinking the other day about this. You learn to live with uncertainty. You don't know what the future is going to be or what next week is going to be. But in a curious way, we always live with uncertainty. It's just that I hadn't realized it before, how quickly the blinds could come down. It reshapes everything. Everything that I look at, a friend of mine calls it the cancer eye. You look at it with that. And I suppose it's an acceptance of a kind of foreshortening of all our arrangements.
Carol's reading on her sofa, then she's sitting at her computer.
I was grateful that I had something to do, and writing was what I had to do. It was my work, if you like, and so that every day, or almost every day, I sat down and went into that very familiar, very comforting routine of putting words on paper. And the words, of course, were different now, and I think they'll never be quite the same as they were.
She's holding a plant outside a florist's.
I think you're better.
Life is a thing to be cherished, she thinks. And this thought, slender as a handrail, gets her through one more night. Next to the florist's is a delicatessen where rare honeys and olives can be found. She is a woman whose life is crowded with not unpleasant errands and with the entrapment of fragrant, familiar, and sometimes enchanting items, all of which possess a reassuring, measurable weight and volume. Not that this is much of a handrail to hang on to. She knows that, and so do I. But it is at least continuous, solid, reliable as a narrative in its turnings, and better than no handrail at all.
She watches her grandson stirring eggs with a fork.
I'm almost done this bit.
Very nice.
Now how? Nice, Evan. Beat it up harder, hen.
Harder.
So it's kind of a frothy, foamy thing.
I've always wondered what people did when they understood that their lives were perhaps going to be shorter or different. And what I found out is that most people want to go on doing exactly what they've been doing.
So stir.
It would have been good.
Why do mothers always sound like that? So singing a little bit, making rhymes.
Very few people want to go to Antarctica, for example, or take up new habits, smoked salmon for breakfast, which I tried temporarily until I got tired of it. And I feel that I want to keep my life pretty much in the same channel. I want to see my friends. I want to see my family. I want to do a little writing every day if I can.
Who do you belong to?
She walks to a house with Dawn.
I didn't want to talk about it for a long time, and I didn't. If you live in a place like Winnipeg, everyone knows anyway, because these things just are known. And eventually the press knew, and eventually I was asked to give a talk at Cancer Awareness Day in Toronto.
She now lives in Winnipeg, where she is professor of English at the University of Manitoba and chancellor of the University of Winnipeg. In November 1998, Carol was diagnosed with breast cancer and has undergone a mastectomy. Please welcome Carol Shields.
At the Canadian Breast Cancer Foundation event, Carol gets up from the long table at the front of the room and stands behind the podium.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I'm delighted to be here, and
I want to greet the organizers of this event.
I guess I was convinced that it might be a good idea, that people undergoing this disease do need to hear from people that they might think would never be hit with this kind of a malady. So I was persuaded, and I did give a talk.
I felt uncoordinated and stupid during this time, afflicted by what I've come to think of cancer clumsiness, involving a new and far from beautiful body shape, and an ugly drainage mechanism made of cardboard and plastic tubing, which was with me for 7 weeks. I was also unbalanced by new intimations of mortality. And then after a month, something happened. I believed it. I accepted it. I got used to being a woman with breast cancer, a woman whose ongoing life was, for the moment anyway, ongoing. I went for 24-hour periods occasionally without weeping, then 48-hour periods. I bought a wig and had a friend stitch up some scarves.
I don't want to run around doing this all the time. I think some people do make cancer their hobby. I don't want it to be my hobby. I want to do, I want to work on a film script. I want to write another novel. I want to put my energy into other things which have nothing at all to do with breast cancer.
At the University of Winnipeg,
for the voting members of the board.
You didn't recognize me with hair, did you?
And then we're just going to drive across the country like pioneers,
you
know?
The dinner tonight, so I need to say.
I've been chancellor here for 4 years, and today marks the end of my term. I was on a kind of double track at one time in my 30s, where I was doing an advanced degree in literature. At the same time, I was invited to teach at a university, and I have always taught part-time.
I don't need to sit out there, I just need some water.
I love the university here.
Now, Carol and her husband are holding the corners of a sheet covering a framed painting.
Don's always had a really small hair.
Just like when we were first married.
Off go the clothes.
They remove the sheet to reveal a painting of Carol in her black university robes with golden lines, standing in front of bookshelves with her hands folded in front of her and a soft smile on her face. Carol's sitting at a table surrounded by lush greenery and plants in a garden, reading from the Stone Diaries.
Something has occurred to her, something transparently simple, something she's always known, it seems, but never articulated, which is that the moment of death occurs while we're still alive. Life marches right up to the wall of that final darkness, one extreme state of being butting against the other. Not even a breath separates them, not even a blink of the eye. A person can go on, tuned in to the daily music of food and work and weather and speech, right up to the last minute, so that not a single thing gets lost. She's surprisingly heartened by this thought.
Oh, no, but we must. We must think about what we're going to have.
Maybe it is because of being so interested in the ordinary things, the so-called ordinary things, that she's continually bolstered and continually moving herself out of any kind of despair. Or
she and my father have sent each of the kids a book on dying, about how people mourn, what the word hope means in times like this. And I think they understand that the written word and hearing about other people's experiences are all very helpful for our people to sort of move through these kinds of periods in our lives.
I don't know that she's braver than anyone else. I think she's probably more mentally active than many. But I think she feels as we do, that she's been cheated. Really. Another 20 years would be wonderful. And we don't know that she'll get that.
have a normal life and normal kitchen.
But it's you when it doesn't work.
Because they thought I was so old.
I always think of how hard it is to be a human being. You never get a day off. You have to be up somehow, in some way, and something has to help you to serve as some kind of a shield between you and the world, or the way in which you want to project yourself. And for years I've been interested in watching people, how they do it. And a lot of women do it with jewelry or with gestures, and men do it with of course, neckties or beards or some way, sunglasses or whatever. But we make those conscious choices about how we go out into the world every single day.
It was a feminist collective. At first they objected to having a wedding picture on the cover at all.
She breaks all the stereotypes that if one has stereotypes about authors and how authors have to be selfish, or authors have to be narcissistic, how authors have to be driven in a certain way. As soon as I find myself uttering any kind of stereotype about an author, I say, well, except with Carol Shields, because she's just the nicest, most caring, generous person.
Remember, she's of the generation still where a woman did not speak her mind. But Carol then, of course, lived through all of women's liberation and also became, you know, an academic and a cherished writer and learned that she can speak her mind. But I think she speaks her mind most often on the page. Her assessment of human frailty is compassionate, but it's not Pollyanna-like.
I think she has decided to be gentle and charming. I think it's a decision. And that is how she is prepared to meet the world. But that doesn't mean that she goes into her writing room and is gentle and charming all the time there. And you can tell that that isn't what goes on in there because you can read the books.
That's one of the great things about Carol, I think, is that she's good without necessarily being nice. She can be quite severe about people and very funny about them. Because she's very acute about people, she can get people very quickly.
I'll just tell you this before you eat that.
Laughing with friends.
We're leaving Winnipeg after 20 years. We're on our way to Victoria. We would stay in Winnipeg permanently. We do love it here, and we have a lot of friends here, but the winters get harder as you get older. So it's really the weather. We want to be able to walk every day and be outside more. We traded in a two-bedroom apartment for a very large house, ridiculously large for just two people. I don't know why we did this. It was a moment of madness. I think we had a feeling that we wanted to live on the ground again.
Getting out of their car.
Now what?
Carol's in a headscarf.
Carol's always wanted to go back into a house. And so I thought, well, if she's not healthy and her days are perhaps more counted than one had hoped, why not?
A large lobby.
And then the best room in the house in many ways, and where we spend most of our time, is here in the living room, which is beautiful and bright, as you can see during the day, but is quite intimate at night with all the lamps and a fireplace and a bookcase and the ticking of clocks. Clocks were always a hobby of mine. And I think it started from one's concern about the passage of time and how time controls our lives and yet is something that we invented. And you can watch the sun on its trajectory through the skies and over our lives. So that's why we love it, this great house of ours.
Walking in the garden.
Well, I had a recurrence, so I am now in the middle of a treatment, chemotherapy. We're just waiting to see if what will happen.
She's sitting in her conservatory and reading a book while wearing a blue hat. Now, Carol and her husband are walking through a busy airport. A staff member checks Carol's ID card. They're on the aeroplane.
I suppose we all have something to reach for in times of emotional bankruptcy or loss.
And what I always reach for is this kind of idea that something else is going to happen, something exciting, something that I want to see. So that's what keeps me going, just that.
Toronto. Getting photos taken at an event.
This is not a woman who thinks that death is looking over her shoulder. This is a woman who thinks she's looking in the face of life. She is embracing today, right now. She wants to be here with her family at this play, giving to us.
Carol's in a sparkly top.
Thank you very much for dropping her. Thank you for Larry's party. I said that to you 5 years ago. And thank you very much for the whole show.
She's being interviewed.
We're also very, very honored this evening that Carol Shields, come on up, Carol, you come up.
She crosses the busy room to the podium in the corner, and the host kisses her cheek before stepping aside.
Let me give my great thanks to you for your sensitivity, for opening up this story, One Man's Life, and for giving us an evening that I don't think you find very often on the musical stage, this feeling of great tenderness and the importance of the shape of our lives. My thanks to you all.
She picks up her drink and grins while the people standing in the room applaud. She takes a seat in the audience.
Well, I seem positive probably because I've come to a certain sense of peace with this disease, which has come out of nowhere. But I'm not, I suppose, overly optimistic about where this is going to lead. There is no cure, so there's no true remission.
Carol's sitting by her computer and reading some printed out pages. Working on Unless.
I am writing a novel. I'm breaking one of the rules with this new novel. I'm writing about a writer, but I wanted to write about a writer. And this might be my last novel, so I thought, well, I'm going to do it.
She takes off her glasses and gets up from her chair.
Now, it's taking shape, it's finding its shape, and I was ready to throw it all away last week, but then I thought how I figured out a way to fix it. And I guess what I love is having this huge task waiting, kind of humming in the background, that I can go back to. It's another place to go and to be.
Dawn's gardening.
Yes, it's amazing, those. All those little bulbs will just be opening.
There, they're worms.
They are true lovers, the two of them together. They are truly part of each other's lives so intensely.
Oh, no.
They are two lobes, in a sense, because we have the science that my father is, and then we have the arts side from my mother.
Nest it back in there.
They're an amazing couple, of course. I mean, one of the great couples, Carol and Dawn. I mean, their love for each other is just so apparent whenever one sees them.
He's wormed into the pages of it over the years, and the goodness that exists in a lot of her characters, I think, is the goodness that's in him.
The Venerable Bede, in one of his ecclesiastical writings, was talking about how brief our life is, really, and he compared it to a bird who flies by accident out of the darkness and into a lighted feasting hall, medieval feasting hall, and then out the other side into darkness, so that one's consciousness of life is this very brief moment in this extraordinary place. And I always thought it was a beautiful image, but how much better it would be if we were flying across that hall with another bird by our side.
While standing on the rocks by the water, Dawn and Carol embrace each other. Wearing dark sunglasses, Dawn's smiling over Carol's shoulder.